Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And when I was a younger man, I didn't appreciate many of the arts, literature, poetry even, that I do appreciate now. I remember my junior year English class, we were doing the poetry section in English, and our homework assignment was to bring in a poem to read aloud. So just go find a poem, come and bring it in and tell people what you think of it. And during class, I was making these snide comments to the teacher saying, I think poetry is silly and I don't get it. And I just think it's kind of overblown. And I was reprimanded for that gently, of course. So a few days go by and we have our assignments and we all get up in front of the class. And I got up and I read a poem. It was about finding flowers in a garden, and the main character debates whether he should go and pick the flower or not, and he doesn't, and he leaves. When he comes back, it's already gone, and he feels this sad sense of forlorn and sorrow at the fact that he had not done that while he was here walking through the garden. And so that was the poem that I read, and my teacher said, that was a really good poem. Who wrote it? And I said, I wrote it. It doesn't mean anything. See, anybody can come up with this stuff. So that was me being a troublemaker then. But maybe I actually did write something that had a fair amount of meaning. I just knew how to put words together. Me figure out how to put words together? Who would have thought? So what I want to do today on the podcast for Free for All Friday, and so I thought, why not share with you now, since then, my cultural tastes have widened a fair amount. I want to share with you my 9 favorite poems. Now, I use poem loosely. Some of them are monologues that have been delivered in plays, but I still call them poems. And I think it's important for us as Catholics, it's important for anybody to study the arts, to understand the richness of the human condition, and to dive deep into the human heart, really. And poetry is able to do that. So I want to share these poems with you, and especially if you're Catholic, I think it's important when we learn about our faith, we want to share our faith with others. We can't learn just arguments and facts. Those are important, but what we share, our faith, is not just the true, it's not just the good, it's also the beautiful, that anything we see that is beautiful in this life is ultimately a reflection of God. And I think through these authors, some of whom are not religious or may have been anti-religious, God's beauty is able to shine through the beauty of human authors in a variety of works. So let us then start with my 9 favorite poems. And while we go through them, I mean, most of them are pretty famous poems. You've probably heard of them before, so these aren't just esoteric. I'm not a poet laureate scholar or anything like that. These are just the ones that I like. They're really good, and most people also like them as well. Though I bet as you listen to me read through them, you might be able to do a deeper psychological analysis on me to see why these particular poems stick out to me. So let's start with my 9 top poems. Number 9, Invictus by William Ernest Henley, published in 1888. Invictus is actually quoted in a lot of different works, including C.S. Lewis's 1933 work, Pilgrim's Regress. Henley wrote this poem while he was recovering from an operation to save his non-amputated foot. When he was 16 years old, part of his leg had to be amputated due to a complication because of tuberculosis. And while he was writing the Invictus, actually, this is not the title of the play. It was untitled, known by a lot of other titles. It was given the title Invictus later. It's Latin for unconquered. So he wrote it while he was recovering from this operation, which in 19th century, I think it was England, in the 19th century, surgical operations are not the most fun thing to be a part of. So Invictus. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how strait the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. So Invictus, to courageously march forward with what we need to do. Now, of course, one can take the attitude from Invictus in the completely wrong direction and misunderstand it, and that can lead to hubris, which is the subject of our next poem that I enjoy, which is Ozymandias by Percy Shelley, published in 1818. Ozymandias is based on an inscription at the base of a statue, I believe it was taken to the British Museum, of Ramses II, who is believed by many scholars to have been the pharaoh of the Egypt during the Exodus. At the base of this statue, it says, "King of kings am I, Ozymandias," that's the Greek rendering of Ramses' Egyptian name. "If anyone would know how great I am and where I lie, let him surpass one of my works." So this is, based on that inscription, this is Shelley's Ozymandias. "I met a traveler from an antique land who said, 'Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear: My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." So we might build up towers, we might build up monuments to ourselves in this life, but ultimately they become colossal wrecks, a shattered visage. The next poem to look at is actually an excerpt from Shakespeare's play, the pastoral comedy As You Like It, published in 1623. It's Act 2, Scene 7. As You Like It is about, I don't have all the whole story right in my head. I just remembered this part. About the two women who are fleeing from a court, I think it's the Duché court in France is where it's located, into the forest to meet other exiled nobles. This portion is read by a character named Jacques, who's kind of a melancholy fellow. You've no doubt heard it before, but it's called The Seven Ages of Man. It's originally found Act 2, Scene 7 of As You Like It. So here it is. "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the bard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly, with good cap and lind, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved a world too wide for his shrunk shank and his big manly voice turning again towards childish treble, pipes, and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange eventful history. It is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything." Well, as Jesus says in the Gospels, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. From dust you came. Well, that's actually from Job. From dust you came, to dust you shall return. So one of the best summaries of life you might find in a single paragraph. I also enjoy the description, of course, of how the soldier becomes the judge with the fair round belly. Dad bod, if I never heard it by any other name. The next poem that I like, this is genuinely a poem, is a shorter one, but still very powerful. And this takes us away from 17th century Elizabethan England to 20th century, probably Harlem, probably where this would be composed, a poem by Langston Hughes called Dream Deferred. Let's see. Oh, did I? Now, oh, you see, I did dream variations, but I want, Mr. Computer, I would like a dream. Here's my dream. Oh, it's called Harlem. It's Harlem. Yeah, that's why I thought Harlem. The play, this poem is called Dream Deferred by some people. Its real title is Harlem, probably where it was written by Langston Hughes. So I have a dream to read this poem to you, and it's been deferred. Now it's here. So Harlem by Langston Hughes. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? I had to leave a little silence there for you just to take that in. What happens to a dream deferred? Wonderful poem by Langston Hughes. And I just love, especially in poems, when someone can use words to craft the perfect visual landscape for me. That's something I always enjoy seeing in poetry, vivid descriptions. I'll probably have to do a separate Free For All Friday on some of my favorite literature that has those vivid descriptions but doesn't go too overboard on it. Next up is, this is not a poem per se, but I want to count it. It's the opening monologue to Tennessee Williams' play, The Glass Menagerie. So this was a play premiered in 1944 in Chicago, and it really helped to launch Tennessee Williams' career as a playwright and a novelist. So launched him out of obscurity into fame, and it's a wonderful play. I really appreciate it. The play is somewhat autobiographical based on Williams' life, and it only stars four characters, and one character who's never seen but kind of looms over the whole production. The play Glass Menagerie is about Tom Wingfield. He begins the story. The monologue I'll share with you is Wingfield reflecting on his past, revisiting it and where he grew up, that he lived with his mother and his sister Laura. So his mother, Amanda Wingfield, is kind of a Southern belle, and she had her glory days a long time ago. And now that those are long gone because she's divorced, her husband left the family like 16 years earlier, and she's kind of gone batty ever since. So Tom works at a shoe store, but he wants a better life for himself, and he feels guilty about having to support his family. And his sister Laura is mentally fragile. She had an illness as a child. It's possible that Laura may be a representation actually of something like autism or Asperger's. She is marked by a kind of inferiority and shyness, and her mother, Amanda, desperately wants to marry her off, and Amanda kind of wants to live vicariously through her. Later in the story, a gentleman caller comes for dinner to hopefully be a suitor for Laura. And it's one of Tom's old friends who works at the shoe warehouse named Jim, and things don't go so well. And looming over everything is a picture of Mr. Wingfield, the father and husband who ran off a while back. So I just love the monologue that is put forward. If you want to look up a neat delivery of it, John Malkovich in the film version of Glass Menagerie does a really good job of delivering this opening monologue. So I will do my best with my try of it. Yes, I have tricks in my pocket. I have things up my sleeve. But I am the opposite of a stage magician. He gives you illusion that has the appearance of truth. I give you truth in the pleasant disguise of illusion. To begin with, I turn back time. I reverse it to that quaint period, the 30s. When the huge middle class of America was matriculating in a school for the blind. Their eyes had failed them, or they had failed their eyes. So they were having their fingers pressed forcibly down on the fiery braille alphabet of a dissolving economy. In Spain, there was revolution. Here, there was only shouting and confusion. In Spain, there was Guernica. Here, there were disturbances of labor, sometimes pretty violent. and otherwise peaceful cities such as Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis. This is the social background of the play. The play is memory. Being a memory play, it is dimly lighted. It is sentimental. It's not realistic. In memory, everything seems to happen to music. That explains the fiddle in the wings. I am the narrator of the play, and also a character in it. The other characters are my mother, Amanda, my sister Laura, and a gentleman caller who appears in the final scenes. He is the most realistic character in the play, being an emissary from a world of reality that we were somehow set apart from. But since I have a poet's weakness for symbols, I am using this character also as a symbol. He is the long-delayed but always expected something that we live for. There is a fifth character in the play who doesn't appear except in this larger-than-life-size photograph over the mantle. This is our father, who left us a long time ago. He was a telephone man who fell in love with long distance. He gave up his job with the telephone company and skipped the light fantastic out of town. Last we heard of him was a picture postcard from Mazatlan on the Pacific coast of Mexico, containing a message of two words: hello, goodbye, and no address. I think the rest of the play will explain itself. So, definitely a play worth watching if you can see the whole thing. I very much enjoy The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. Next up is a poem by Roald Dahl. I'm not a gigantic Roald Dahl fan. I'm not a big fan of, you know, James and the Giant Peach, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. There's a few things in Roald Dahl's head that I'm not quite sure are entirely screwed in. But if you're going to be a wonderful poet and author, you kind of have to have a few screws loose. Ask Emily Dickinson. But this is a play of his that I thoroughly enjoy. It's called Television. It's about kids watching television. And yes, I let my kids watch television. Roald Dahl did have children of his own. I'm sure he was tempted to let them watch TV. My wife and I would do our best, okay? Though honestly, I feel like Miss Frizzle teaches my kids way more than I ever could when it comes to science. But this is Television by Roald Dahl. The most important thing we've learned so far as children are concerned is never, never, never let them near your television set. Or better still, just don't install the idiotic thing at all. In almost every house we've been, we've watched them gaping at the screen. They loll and slop and lounge about and stare until their eyes pop out. Last week in someone's place, we saw a dozen eyeballs on the floor. They sit and stare and stare and sit until they're hypnotized by it, until they're absolutely drunk with all that shocking, ghastly junk. Oh yes, we know it keeps them still. They don't climb out the windowsill. They never fight or kick or punch. They leave you free to cook the lunch and wash the dishes in the sink. But did you ever stop to think, to wonder just exactly what this does to your beloved tot? It rots the sense in the head. It kills imagination dead. It clogs and clutters up the mind. It makes a child so dull and blind he can no longer understand a fantasy, a fairy land. His brain becomes as soft as cheese. His powers of thinking rust and freeze. He cannot think. He only sees. All right, you'll cry. All right, you'll say. But if we take the set away, what shall we do to entertain our darling children? Please explain. We'll answer this by asking you, what use the darling ones to do? How use do they keep themselves contented before this monster was invented? Have you forgotten? Don't you know? We'll say it very loud and slow. They used to read. They'd read and read and read and read, and then proceed to read some more. Great Scott, gadzooks. One half their lives was reading books. The nursery shelves held books galore, books cluttering up the nursery floor. And in the bedroom by the bed, more books were waiting to be read. Such wondrous, fine, fantastic tales of dragons, gypsies, queens, and whales, and treasure isles and distant shores where smugglers rode with muffled oars, and pirates wearing purple pants and sailing ships and elephants, and cannibals crouching round the pot, stirring away at something hot, Smells so good. What can it be? Good gracious, it's Penelope. The younger one, said Beatrix Potter, with Mr. Todd the Dirty Rotter, and Squirrel Nutkin Pigling Bland, and Mrs. Tiggly Winkle, and just how the camel got his hump, and how the monkey lost his rump, and Mr. Toad, and bless my soul, there's Mr. Rat and Mr. Mole. Oh, books, what books they used to know. Those children living long ago. So please, oh please, we beg, we pray, go throw your TV set away, and in its place you can install a lovely bookshelf on the wall. Then fill the shelves with lots of books, ignoring all the dirty looks, the screams and yells, the bites and kicks, and children hitting you with sticks. Fear not, because we promise you that in about a week or two of having nothing else to do, they'll now begin to feel the need of having something to read. And once they start, oh boy, you watch the slowly growing joy that fills their hearts. They'll grow so keen, they'll wonder what they'd ever seen in that ridiculous machine, that nauseating, foul, unclean, repulsive television screen. And later, each and every kid will love you more for what you did. Television by Roald Dahl. Interesting fact, Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury is not primarily about censorship. Bradbury's main theme was actually that television was going to destroy people's imaginations and turn us into mindless wastes that a totalitarian state could take advantage of. But you know what? All good things in moderation. Next Free For All Friday, my 9 favorite television shows. I say this as Roald Dahl spins in his grave, in his giant peach of a grave filled with Willy Wonka's chocolates, no doubt. Maybe I should write a follow-up to this. Roald Dahl, now imagine him, that people put on Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach on TV to keep their kids entertained. The poor guy's just screaming, no! All righty, now we've entered the top three. The top three contenders for my favorite pieces of poetry. Coming in with a bronze medal is The Love Song of Alfred J. Prufrock by T.S. Eliot, published in 1915. Literary scholars are not entirely sure of the meaning. We have the general idea of what the poem is about, but exactly who is being spoken to or not is a bit ambiguous. And I like poems that have some ambiguity to them. It lets you kind of fill in the blanks here. So this one's a little bit longer, but I think well worth it. Just a little bit of time. Some poetry is good for you and I. So this is number three for me, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed, there will be time, for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes, there will be time, there will be time, to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you, and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions, and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed, there will be time to wonder, do I dare? And do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair. With a bald spot in the middle of my hair, they will say, how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie, rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. For I have known them all already, known them all. I have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. And when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways? And how should I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, downed with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl? And should I then presume? How should I begin? Shall I say I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows? I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. In the afternoon, the evening, sleep so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, where it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head, grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter, I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short, I was afraid. And it would have been worth it after all, after the cups, the marmalade, the tea among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me. Would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the manor with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball? To roll it towards some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus come from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all, if one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all. And it would have been worth it after all. Would it have been worthwhile? After the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets, after the novels, after the teacups, after the skirts that trail along the floor, and this and so much more, it is impossible to say just what I mean. But as if a magic lantern threw the nerves in patterns on a screen, would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. No! I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince, no doubt, an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse, at times indeed almost ridiculous, almost at times the fool. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I've seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back. When the wind blows the water white and black, we have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown. Till human voices wake us and we drown. The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot. That sense of longing to make such an important decision in life and the regret when we don't and let time race by us, so to speak. But maybe it means something different to you. That's what's great about poetry. You get to derive different meanings. Sometimes poems say more about you than you say about the poem, you know. Number two, the silver medal, goes to another famous poem, The Tiger, by William Blake, published part of the Songs of Innocence in 1794. It actually has a companion poem, The Lamb. The Tiger is the more famous one. And this is shorter than the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, but, you know, hey, it all works out, people. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? And it's symmetry, not symmetry. Otherwise, you lose the whole rhyming of the poem. But this one, you know, we're taking back in a religious path that we see the beauty and wonder of God and wonder, you know, sometimes you see God, there's the calm, we see him. Honestly, some of the times in nature I see God the most is in a Midwest thunderstorm. We get thunderstorms here, but they're not scary. You got to go to the Midwest. Oklahoma, Missouri, that gets a scary thunderstorm. So sometimes in a peaceful field, I hear God, but those thunderstorms, I get a bigger appreciation. And now number one, what could be my favorite poem in the history of the world? Well, I'm biased, but I think it's appropriate. It's the Magnificat, the Song of Mary, that you're familiar with, that speaks to the humble recognition that God would choose to work through us. Who? Me? Not because of anything special about me, but because of what's special about God. And now to leave you, dear listener, my favorite poem, Luke 1:47-45. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed, for he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his posterity forever. So I hope you enjoyed spending a little bit of time with me, getting to share with you some of my favorite poems. Do you have a favorite poem? Come down to TrentHornPodcast.com. I have the episodes there as well. And in the comments section, hey, tell me what your favorite poem is. I would love to hear about that. At TrentHornPodcast.com. I have a lot of episodes you can comment on for free. Other bonus content there you can access as well if you're a monthly subscriber and you keep the podcast going. So we can share that which is true, that which is good, and that which is beautiful with the world. I hope this was rejuvenating for your soul this Friday to send you off on the weekend. Have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.